Okay, we will bring the committee hearing to order, and thank you all, you know, for coming today. I actually have to get downstairs here to vote on another piece of legislation briefly, and then I'll come back up. So I think I'm going to turn it over to Senator Marty to continue things, who's co-chairing the meeting today, and I will be right back.
Perhaps we should start with the health department right away. Don Linkstein. Appreciate all of you, the state agency folks, for coming, and I think the legislature and public and everybody's very interested in hearing where things are headed.
Please go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John Linkstein, Assistant Commissioner for Health Protection from the Minnesota Department of Health, and Chris Erisman, Division Director for Infectious Disease of Epidemiology Prevention and Control Division, is at the table with me. I'm going to be brief today, but the department has been actively responding to the development of this H1N1 novel influenza over the past 10 days or so, and I just want to quickly give you a story, because sometimes we get rather factual and detailed, and sometimes it might be helpful for you to hear how the response happens in late night hours or not news to legislators, so you'll understand this. Our first probable case came in the afternoon, late afternoon, middle of last week. Our laboratory staff have developed testing procedures to evaluate H1N1 viruses of the type A, and have been working with the CDC to understand how to test for these viruses. And they came up with a probable case late in the evening, and it was about midnight when our commissioner received a call from our laboratory staff and our state epidemiologist, Dr. Ruth Linfield, saying that it was a likely case of H1N1 novel influenza, formerly referred to as the swine flu. So it was about 1 o'clock in the morning then when they completed their phone conversation with school district officials in the city of Cold Spring for the Ricori School District. And it was about 1:30 in the morning that a number of us were called to prepare for dealing with the school situation. And at that time, when we had very little information about the extent of this virus and movement through our population, we were acting rather cautiously and conservatively with respect to schools and school children. And so we made sure that we were prepared with the school district to take action in the morning, and the school district officials decided to close school in concert with the CDC's guidelines for 7 days. We were up there at 7 o'clock in the morning. I met the police chief from the city of Cold Spring and the school district administrator, Scott Staska, and the police chief, Bill Jones. I want to give you a sense of what that morning was like. The police chief was preparing the parking lot of the school for the arrival of several vehicles from the media. The school superintendent was gathering up his staff, and the school teachers and faculty and other staff. And there were a number of conversations that had to occur within that 6 to 7 hour period of time. And I bring that up because this is what public health is all about, is rapid identification. Pardon me. That will be another conversation to have later. As the rapid response to learning of a new set of information and working with our community partners across many fronts is how we work in public health. And we're pleased to tell you that the work that we have been doing in public health, not just since we started thinking about pandemic flu and other causes of illness and disease and death in our communities, but because of the work public health does from the local government level, from nursing in clinics around the state, to hospitals, to communities, to school nurses, to nursing homes, to all levels of public health response, is a very, very active and robust system of response. And we're very pleased to be a part of that system, and I just want to let you know that our Our goal is to maintain, protect, and improve the health of all Minnesotans, and we do that with this network of community relationships. So I'm going to let Chris Erisman, our Director of Infectious Disease, Epidemiology, Prevention, and Control, give you a little bit of an update on the influenza situation, and then we'll be here to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Erisman. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. In addition to being the director of our infectious disease group, I've also been serving as the incident manager of this situation, so I'll give you a bit of an update. I'd like to make three important points. One is that, as you heard from Assistant Commissioner Stein, we are prepared and in fact have been working in the middle of the night to respond to this situation. But as you've seen over the last 10 days, it is very fluid and has required a great deal of flexibility on our part, which can be challenging both for us and for our partners. And then just to emphasize, as we've mentioned before, that really our success is completely dependent on our partnership. The Department of Health alone would not be able to respond to this situation if we hadn't partnered with other state agencies, with local public health, with schools and clinics and all the many groups that you've heard of already. But let me begin by sort of answering, I think, a question that's been on a lot of people's minds, and that is, why this really strong public health response? Because so far, as we've heard, thankfully, all of the cases that have been reported in Minnesota have been relatively mild or more like seasonal influenza. And actually, our vigorous response is because of several factors. There are really three things that we look at in terms of, can a situation have the potential to result in a pandemic? And the first is there a novel virus or a novel strain? And in this situation, in fact, there was. The H1N1 novel influenza strain that you've heard about has not been seen in the human population in this generation, nor had it been seen in swine populations. So we had met that criteria, that we had a virus that had not been circulating in the population, and so therefore our population doesn't have, their immune systems don't have the memory to be able to respond. So that was a concern. Then the second thing that we look for is evidence of human-to-human transmission. There have historically been cases of swine influenza reported in humans, but the humans acquired the illness from pigs. And I'm sure you've all seen the little picture that's been circulating, at least through all of our emails, of the little child kissing the pig on the nose. And that's not necessarily how things are transmitted, but that, in a lot of cases, that's what people think of. Well, in this situation, the cases have not had contact with pigs. So what we know is that the transmission has been human to human. So that was the second criteria that we would look for. And then the third criteria was that of severe disease. And while we haven't really seen severe disease in the United States, we had evidence of that in Mexico. And so the fact that we had all three of those elements made the public health community realize that we had to respond to this situation in a very vigorous manner. So from the standpoint of the public, I think there's probably this feeling like, wow, it's a lot of overkill. But from a public health perspective, we have those three elements, and we need to be prepared to respond based on that. Now, we're very pleased that this has been mild. But as I said, we have to have the systems in place so that if it does evolve, which it certainly could do, that we're ready to respond. Our response efforts have really been intended to evaluate the impact of the outbreak on Minnesota. What does it look like? Who's getting sick? What's the severity? And then to initiate the control measures necessary to respond to the present situation and also be prepared, as I said, if there is an evolution or change in how the virus is presenting itself. We have been planning for sort of the big one, and right now what we're seeing does not represent that, but nonetheless, we want to understand and respond. And so to that end, as the Assistant Commissioner mentioned, we've enhanced our case detection efforts. So our epidemiology staff as well as our laboratory staff have been triaging with clinicians to see what individuals would need testing. Our public health laboratory has been working around the clock, and as of yesterday, we had received 462 specimens, 443 had been tested, 19 were still pending, and we have the one confirmed case that you're aware of, and then we have 9 probable cases. We're still waiting to hear from CDC on those, but as you can imagine, they are inundated with specimens as well. And we've been working with local public health in the that have cases in their communities to help them with their response, and then they have been responding appropriately. Communication with the public is a large part of what we need to do, and so we've updated our website. We've had over 200,000 hits in the last few days. We have a public information line that's been running, which has included a TC Wild, though we realize that the Minnesota Relay system is more appropriate for our deaf and hard of hearing residents, so we've moved to that. We also have had a clinician hotline. Because of the links to Mexico, we've had a special outreach for Latino populations. We had staff at Cinco de Mayo. We've had messages on Spanish radio and been working with those communities. And today we have a forum that will include over 50 members of communities from across the state, including the Somali community, the Latino community, the Hmong community. So we have a lot of community partners that we're working with. I think you've heard about the deployment of antivirals across the state. They've been deployed pre-positioned in 8 different regions in central locations, and the reason for that is so that when they're needed, the distance to any location is sort of equal, and we can get them out quickly. I think that the message that has recently been updated is the question of closing schools, and I think that I'm sure that you're wondering, well, why close schools initially and then now have a different perspective? And the reason for closing the schools initially was really as a precautionary measure. From an epidemiologic perspective, we always want to look at person, place, and time. Who's getting sick? When are they getting sick? And where are they getting sick? And so when we had the first case in someone associated with a school, we needed to look at more of what was happening in that situation, how severe were things, was there ongoing transmission. But our staff have actually interviewed 550 out of 675 individuals associated with that school and have not seen evidence of transmission. So we're looking at the fact that closing schools may not be as effective in reducing transmission as we'd like and may have other consequences that we don't want to have. In addition to that, we haven't seen transmission, and then the cases have been mild. So those are all some of the factors that have gone into the decision to not closing schools. And then I'll just let you know that we're talking about things that we did last week, how they've changed. Uncertainty is certainly part of our work. And so we need to constantly be responding to changes in the situation, and we will continue to do that. And then I just want to acknowledge again the importance of the partnerships that we've had with the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Education, local public health, clinics, health systems, and the school systems. That has been incredibly important in our response. So I'll just close by saying that our response efforts are cumulative. That is, the lessons that we're learning this week from our response to this initial presentation of H1N1 novel influenza will guide and improve our next response. And we've learned a lot in the last 10 days, many changes that we can make to improve how we do things. So we have a lot more work to do, but we'll be that much better prepared as this situation evolves. And I thank you for your support of our work.
I think Reverend Gottwald has a question.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the information. This is really, really good for us to have. I know there have been concerns among pork producers, in particular in the state, that there's been an illegitimate connection between consumption of pork or pigs and this strain of flu. Can you help set that to rest?
Yes, Representative, we are working closely with the Department of Agriculture, the Board of Animal Health, and we have a veterinarian, a public health veterinarian on staff that is developing messaging for the public, and we certainly do know that there's been a report of a partial herd in Alberta, Canada, infected with the virus. It sounds like that was a very contained situation. We met Sunday morning with the Commissioner of Agriculture and the Board of Animal Health and our veterinarian, And what we can say about that is that we believe that the risk to Minnesota's herd is nil, because we do not receive any of our feeder pigs or young pigs from those herds in Canada. And one of the things that we were assured by the Department of Agriculture's Board of Animal Health is that the biosecurity measures in place in the pork industry are very high and very rigorous. And so it's a very unlikely situation that any of Minnesota's herds would become affected by that Alberta herd. And knowing that, we've turned that over to the Board of Animal Health and to the Department of Agriculture and the sort of pork producers and given that information. So the risk to humans, as Ms. Erisman noted, is very low. That's, we're not seeing transmission from animals in the state. People are safe to consume pork. That is a message we want to get out. We also want to be sure that our pork producers in the state have been notified by the Department of Agriculture and the Board of Animal Health to be vigilant and looking for any concerns in their herds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, you're describing this as kind of a mild outbreak. So people should be taking the same precautions they would with any other seasonal flu outbreak.
Ms. Harrison.
Chairman and Representative Rotwell. Yes, in fact, the presentation of the current H1N1 novel influenza, and you'll notice we did change the name, so it's no longer H1N1 flu. Although I have to say that's a little bit easier to say. But the current presentation of H1N1 novel influenza is very much like seasonal influenza. So our message to the public is that they certainly need to be aware of what's going on, but their actions need to be the common sense actions of good hand washing, you know, staying home when you're ill, making sure that you're coughing into your elbow, you know, covering your cough, that kind of thing.
Representative Liebman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for coming here and giving us information today. We have been hearing about preparations for pandemic flu for quite some time, and I just wonder if you could kind of give us a snapshot of how well prepared do you feel that we are here in Minnesota? I mean, we've put some resources into this, and I'm glad to hear about some of the ways that this is working and the partnerships and so on, which I think are really important. But do you feel that you have what you need to take care of the problem?
Sharon and Representative Leaving, yes, the response that we're engaged in right now is the greatest classroom of all. That when we initially prepared and when the country initially prepared for pandemic influenza, you recall that the idea was that this was going to start somewhere else and was going to gradually migrate into the United States. We were, and all government in this country, were kind of looking at that threat from that perspective. What this outbreak has given us the opportunity to work on is, what if it starts here? And that's a little different perspective. We have worked hard with funding that we've received from the federal government and from the legislature to prepare plans. I didn't bring a plan with me today because it's about twice or three times as thick as that, and it's still a work in progress. And we do value the efforts that we have put into that preparation. We've also worked very diligently to provide assistance and funding through grants to local units of government. And I think what you'll hear from Ms. Frauendienst is a little bit about what their experience has been. We definitely are looking at our current needs as well as future needs, and we may have additional needs that will be identified as a result of this classroom experience that we're now in.
Anything in particular that of the lessons that you've learned that you think we need to focus in on?
Mr. Chair, I think I'll let Ms. Erisman jump in on this too, but certainly we know that there's always some challenges with antivirals and supplies of emergency response and personal protective equipment for the medical community. We're still evaluating that. I don't know if that will become an issue, but then the coordination efforts just to complete planning and exercise those plans is important function for us to continue as well.
Okay. I think too that there are lessons that we're learning that will be internally beneficial that don't require additional resources, but will require changes on our part.
So we have four people on the list, and then so Representative Fritz first, and then Representative Button.
Thank you, Mr. Mathewson, and thank you also for being so vigilant. Of course, I'm concerned about the nursing homes, and my daughter does work in a nursing home down in Faribault, and they had already started everything that they need to do. I saw her this weekend, and they were just, really on guard, and her whole demeanor was of that. So that made me feel better. However, I am concerned about the 462 specimens that you mentioned, and the regions where they all from. Not all from the record, but throughout the state, or where in the state? You can answer that, please.
Chairman and Representative, but the specimens have come from throughout the state, and when we talk about the confirmed case is the case that you've heard about from the recording related to the record school. But we've had probable cases identified in Wright County, in Dakota County, in Washington County, and in Hennepin County at this point, and also Isanti County. So it's not limited to the 7-county metro area by any stretch, and the specimens have come from throughout the state. And our feeling is that the H1N1 novel influenza is currently circulating, in communities throughout the state.
That answers my question. So we could be getting it in throughout southern Minnesota. We still have to be on guard. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lane.
Thank you. Dr. Michael Osterholm calls this virus a sloppy, promiscuous virus. But it's mutating continually, and most of the mutations die off, but you never know which one could become quite virulent. And I think that's the thing that people need to be aware of, that just because it's mild now doesn't mean that there's other scenarios that could take place. So he says the only thing you can expect is the unexpected. And maybe you could talk a little bit about the possible scenarios of how this could go, either if it's allowed or get worse.
Certainly, many folks have commented on the 1918 influenza outbreak, which was a mild onset initially and in a similar time, followed by a more virulent strain of the virus, likely is what happened, as there weren't as sophisticated testing methods available in 1918, but the virus did come back with a vengeance, so to speak, later in 1918, the year my father was born. Actually, my dad was born on November 30th, 1918, and so he always credits his mother's personal health habits as the reason that he survived to term at that year, because many of his family members were affected by that flu and had family members that died as a result of that. So I think, there are many scenarios that can develop. It can develop in any direction, from becoming more virulent, as you mentioned, Representative, to even dying off and just sort of trailing away like the typical seasonal influenza. I think, as Ms. Erisman pointed out, there are some novelties to this strain of virus that make us want to remain vigilant and continue to watch for those possible scenarios. And so that's our goal, is to remain vigilant and continue to update our knowledge on the strain as it unfolds. As Dr. Osterholm mentioned, anyone who can predict the future is not telling the truth, because there is no predictable nature to viruses.
Representative Lane, I was just going to comment that because of this unpredictability of the virus, once the media attention drops off and once this isn't on people's minds, we will still be working on this. So the Department of Health will not, stop preparing. We will continue to be prepared so that should there be something else that develops this fall, that we'll be ready for that.
My dad was also born in 1918 in August, and actually was very sick as an infant with the flu, and spent some time and many months in the hospital. And I guess it's those of us who have stories like that take this more seriously than people who have no connection to the 1918 at all. I mean, there's nobody here that has a direct connection, but some of us have heard the story. And I learned from Dr. Osterholm that 55% a pregnant woman died in 1918 because their immune system is already handling so much. This is an extremely precautionary statistic. But I also want to say that I understand our public health system is operating wonderfully. You're doing a wonderful job. The local areas are wonderful. And yet there's other system vulnerabilities that are of great concern to us and we haven't solved. And that, for instance, is, as Dr. Elson talked about, our just-in-time economy. Everything comes to us that we have today. It came across the ocean, for instance, across borders 2 to 3 days ago. And there's nothing in warehouses. It's all constantly on the move. And if something happens, our system would be vulnerable to being shut down, mixed up, and those things would not arrive. And one example is, for instance, a lot of the virus turns to pneumonia, and we need the ventilators. We have plenty of ventilators in hospitals, but we don't have this little disposable device called a circuit that connects you to the ventilator. We have maybe 3 of them at a hospital at a time. And they come from where? Over the border. And this is across, this is our food supplies, our medical supplies, our drug supplies, you name it. Everything is just moving constantly. System vulnerabilities across the United States could be very serious. More people could die of other things besides the flu. So I don't know how Minnesota addresses that, but and I don't even know who we talk to address that, but that's a very
good question. Mr. Chair, Representative Wayne, what you're talking about is hazard vulnerability assessment. Those are efforts of planning in response to emergency events. And as you know, the scenarios are endless. So the way that the federal government and state governments try to work on that is by identifying those hazards and then assessing our vulnerability and working to limit. You can never eliminate your vulnerability, but limit your exposure to the vulnerability by preparing. And this is an example. A vulnerability that we have addressed is an infectious disease such as influenza. We have prepared a system to respond. There are other systems, though, subcomponents of the system that you say are still vulnerable, and we are working always to reduce those vulnerabilities. The food safety system is another area where vulnerability is a constant. We need to be constantly vigilant in reducing vulnerabilities, and that is, you're absolutely right, whether or not we are ever fully prepared, I think, is the test of time. We will certainly continue to work to reduce those vulnerabilities. That's our commitment.
And I would say a robust hospital system would also be on that list of vulnerability. We have Representative Clark and Broad, and Senator Marty has a question, then we'll need to move on because we have session at 9:30.
Thank you very much. I just want to say it was reassuring to hear early on that we had adequate antivirals over at our Minnesota Department of Health. And I wanted to ask just another question about that, which is they are now distributed in three locations. Is the plan to continue that, to maintain those antivirals at those distribution centers? If not, is there some other plan? That's one question. The second question will have to do with what ordinary people can do. But the first one is about our adequate supply or not, and the distribution continuing, or will they come back? And you might mention the expiration date on these antivirals, too.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark. Yes, the pre-deployment of the antivirals in the 8 regions, they will stay in those regions until we evaluate the situation because we want them to be available should they need to develop guidelines for use by clinicians and local public health to evaluate when it would be appropriate to use those supplies. So they will stay in those locations, and the expiration date I don't have on the top of my head, but it is several years. So we and what happens is the manufacturer will retest the product and extend the expiration date, much as what's been happening with smallpox vaccines. So I anticipate that likely happens will happen. But at this point, yes, the plan is to leave them pre-deployed, and then we'll evaluate the situation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the reasons I was wondering is I was. I think that the information I got is like about a 5 or 7 year expiration date, something like that, so that we're in pretty good shape in terms of that. But one of the things that I was talking with an urgent care physician about is that one of the concerns about these antivirals being out there is, will they be used in a prophylactic way, in a preventative way, and might we then get into a situation where we're actually helping the virus become resistant? So I just wanted to ask that, and I noticed that the response to what should I do if I get sick on the education document that the health department has here is, first of all, to call your health care provider to figure out what you should do if you need to be tested, and second is to stay home. And the two of them don't quite go together in some cases, because you think of someone being tested, they're going into perhaps a clinic or maybe an urgent care setting. If they are sick, they're in a scene where they may be passing on their illness to others who are there. If they stay home, they may recover, but you don't know if they are well. So there's kind of a tension there, and I'm just wondering, in terms of that and that whole issue of prevention and prophylaxis, if you've been thinking about that and what you might advise for our medical community, our public health nurses, and so on, because I think this is an actual real bit of a conflict.
And brief answer, if we could.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Clark, yes, we have thought about that. I think what we're encouraging people to do is to contact their health care provider, and then they can make arrangements. We have had situations. For instance, is one of our probable cases in which the healthcare provider made arrangements to have that child come in just at the door and maintain infection control in their setting. And I think the other folks will be able to comment on that. And then in terms of, staying home, we do want people to stay home, but we want to make sure that they have access to healthcare. And then healthcare knows how to manage infection control.
My questions are actually pretty quick. First thing is, are you getting any sense from the federal government that the CDC is going to revise their school closing information? And then second, are you seeing any information coming from the federal government as well in terms of allowing more flexibility for states and using stimulus dollars to help offset some of the costs of dealing with H1N1?
Thank you, Ms. Chair, Representative Broad. Answer your first question is yes, we have received information from CDC that they're actively evaluating their school closure guidelines. Dr. Richard Besser yesterday released a press release saying that they were in active conversation about that. And so we do anticipate further revision. I think as Ms. Erisman noted, this is sort of a cumulative learning experience, and that's true at the federal level as well. And as we learn, we will adjust our guidance. And we did so yesterday for schools in Minnesota. To your second question, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know whether or not the CDC or the federal government is adjusting anything related to the use of the stimulus dollars.
Senator Marsh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My office received an email from somebody who works in a clinic that says the clinics are seeing a lot of people. They're told by their employers they can't return to work unless they have a negative test on the virus, and the department's only testing certain people now. I heard that you are not saying we want all things to test now, but when you do your PR to the hospitals and employers and so on, have you heard this from others that they're being told they can't go back to work until they get a negative test?
Okay.
Yes, we're hearing sort of a range. Our goal is to present a message that encourages employers to respect our request that ill individuals do stay home. Some employers have taken that to be a little bit more stringent than we even have intended. But what we hear on one side, that people who say that they're ill and intend to stay home based on our recommendations are then have some sort of punishment or negative consequence at work. So we want businesses to allow employees to stay home if they're ill. On the other hand, we have not said that people need to have negative symptoms. That would completely overwhelm the healthcare system. But I think it's sort of people balancing. They want to be cautious, and so we appreciate their willingness to be concerned. But we would say that's not necessary.
Mr. Chairman, I hope you can get that message. Oh, continue. I know you got the balance, but just make sure they know that's overreacting.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for taking time to come today. Appreciate it. Ms. Frauenstein. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning.
Yeah, maybe Ms. Stinchfield can come up too at the same time. Welcome to the committee.
Out of respect for your time, I'll try to be really brief. But,
thank you for coming.
Thank you. My name is Renee Frauenstein. I am the Public Health Division Director for Stearns County Human Services in St. Cloud, Minnesota, and I really do appreciate the opportunity to share just a little bit of information about how this affected our county and our response. You've heard a lot from the Minnesota Department of Health about the planning that has occurred, and this is no different for our county. In fact, many, many years ago when the meningitis outbreak occurred in Mankato, I sat down with our emergency manager and said, how would we, Insurance County, respond to this? And from that, we developed the state's first public health disaster response plan that was used as a model across Minnesota for public health. This last week before, as we were beginning to get information from the Minnesota Department of Health and from the Center for Disease Control, we sat down again and said, what are some of the trigger points for Stearns County? And actually Tuesday had put together our plan for notification of our community if it would occur either in Minnesota, in our county, or we would have a death related to this particular influenza virus in the United States. So all of that planning has actually allowed us to create lots of new relationships within our community, as well as conceal many of our old relationships, so that at 3 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday, I was able to pick up the phone and call many of our community partners and ask them to respond. People like our emergency manager, the St. Cloud Hospital, which is our central resource hospital, the Center Care Clinic System, which is where our medical provider, our medical consultant for public health resides, the Minnesota Department of Health, the district staff there, all of our county staff, administration, our human services administration, information systems, we need computers up in the EOC, all that happened. And in fact, I really appreciated the thing called Times Headlines, because I think that tells how we responded, and that was ready and willing. With that, we were able to pretty much respond to what the community needs were. We had gotten a request from individuals to really look at how do we assure that individuals who have lost their jobs and now have no insurance have a resource in the community. And I can tell you within hours, we were able to connect with our providers in the community and designate an area and a process for those individuals to access that care if in fact that they needed it. We were able to connect with areas such as our nursing homes, our clinics, our providers, our daycares, our businesses, our faith community. Those are all partnerships that we've established over these many years. We were able to pick up the phone. I was able to talk with individuals that knew me and respected the work that we at the health department do. These relationships have been critical for us, and it's actually allowed us to really work across systems, public to private. It's allowed private and private to work together. It's allowed us to work across jurisdictions. It's actually allowed us to work across communities. We also were able to really put together some very solid and clear communication lines. We created a joint information system between our county, the Minnesota Department of Health, our local school, and then also the St. Cloud Hospital. And through that, we were able to provide consistent messages to the community that not only met the needs of the individuals in the community, but it also helped us maximize our resources, which certainly are limited. And then obviously, we worked very closely with the Minnesota Department of Health. I cannot tell you how important they are to us as a local system. We really look to our state partner for exactly what they provided us, which is leadership and support to meet our local needs. For example, we were asked from our providers for the treatment guidelines and some clarification on those guidelines. We were able to connect with the Minnesota Department of Health and get that information out. And actually what our providers have done now is they've created what they call the Stearns County Flu Plan. And that really has created a community standard so that we have all individual clinics in our area to support what the response is going to be, and that it implements consistently across all of those systems. But why are we able to do this? I'm going to tell you why. Because we are out there every day creating these partnerships. That is what the work of public health does on a daily basis. And we are able to set aside those activities that we do on a daily basis and reprioritize the priorities. Sometimes that happened daily, sometimes that happened hourly. So we were looking at, we cannot do this piece anymore. We need to pull those individual staff to assist us in that. So that ongoing local structure of people and programs and resources that we have every day are what allows us at the local level to be able to respond to the needs of our public. I think that's what makes Minnesota's public health system one of the finest in the Masons, and it really allows us, when we have these types of situations, to really look at what is it that we need to do, and it allows the citizens of Minnesota to see that that system really is working every day in their lives, including today when they really need it. I am willing to take any questions that the community may have.
I think we'll go to questions, but I'd like to actually have the other testifier give her testimony first with time. We'll run a little bit over here, but go ahead.
Well, thank you for the invitation. My name is Teresa Stanfield. I'm a pediatric nurse practitioner and the director of infectious disease, immunology, and infection prevention control at Children's Hospitals and Clinics in Minnesota. And I want to thank my representative, Erin Murphy, and the entire committee for the invitation to speak today to give the other half of the partnership mirror here on the private side and tell you a little bit about what children's experience has been over the last very interesting 10 days. I want you to know that I have the utmost respect for the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm currently a member of the CDC Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. I was a voting member there for 4 years, and Chris Erisman actually took my seat and is now the voting member. And she and I have wonderful relationships. The state health department and children have amazing relationships. And we've been through these kinds of things before. We went through the measles epidemic in 1990. We've been through smallpox vaccines together. We went through the, if you remember, just 2 years ago, we had 6 deaths from seasonal influenza in children in a 2-week period that caused panic in the community. Driving on the road from Children's Minneapolis to Children's St. Paul, the first person I called was Chris Erisman. In less than 48 hours of planning, we did an emergency flu vaccine clinic for our community. Now we are here together with a new novel virus, and those partnerships are strong and continue to work really, really well. The Minnesota Department of Health is very well known and very well respected in this country. They are best in class, and we are very, very fortunate to have all of them. I think another area that is working so well in Minnesota is the Minnesota Hospital Compact. Those of us on the hospital side have been meeting regularly and talking. We have John Hick from HCMC who leads that group so beautifully. We're also, from children's perspective, connecting with other children's hospitals in the country, Dallas, San Diego, trying to see what they're doing at their epicenter of this outbreak and learning from them as well. So what is happening at Children's? In brief, Children's has typically in the middle of February, our emergency rooms see about 100 kids a day. And here we are in May, we have been at 198 visits to our ED. So we've been between 50% and 100% of our normal numbers in the middle of winter surge. We're past some of the winter viruses. So that has been our number one job, is to try to deal with a surge of patients that have come to the Children's Hospital's emergency department. As we sit in the Minnesota Hospital Compact, the adult hospitals are not telling the same story. I think what's happening is a child sneezes, a parent worries, they hop in the car and they come to the ED. Our clinics have been quite quiet, phone calls are quiet, visits are quiet. They're just passing the normal kind of talking through with their providers and heading straight to the ED. Our emergency room has been doing the screening, trying to figure out, you know, which of these febrile coughing children do we need to move to the top of the line, and using the CDC and MDA screening tools, masking people individually right away, moving people who meet our criteria into a negative airflow room, and triaging and treating them that way. We've expanded our emergency room spaces into our short stay units. We've augmented our staff despite a quite lean budget situation at our hospital. Our COO sees the need to do that. So we have emergency room staff that even just 10 days into it are really tired. I want to especially recognize the Spanish-speaking interpreters who have really taken a significant and unique burden trying to explain between the provider and the parent what they need to do and wearing a mask at the same time. And so that has been very demanding. Children's Institute, our HICS emergency management system, I have studied and thought a lot about influenza viruses for most of my career in infectious disease, and the minute I saw this combination, I thought we are in for some hard work here. We have 3 efforts that I want to just end with that we focused on at Children's. One is the surge and how to best deal with it. We've been developing overflow plans and developed some criteria of when we move outside of our normal operations and create emergency triages, keeping within power laws, et cetera, in other spaces, for example, evening, using our clinic space or hospital auditorium. How do we staff those? How do we get supplies there? What about real emergencies, et cetera? So the surge has been really one of our biggest areas of focus. The second F is supplies. We have burned through N95 personal protective masks very quickly. It has concerned those of us in emergency preparedness. We've tapped into our own personal emergency cash at Children's for more N95. And when you need them, and everybody needs them at the same time, the supply chain is very interesting. And so I think that is the area that we'll continue to look at how we keep these supplies. And I respect and admire the flexibility, and as we learn about this virus, as it evolves, as we learn about how it impacts people, we change up our strategies. And so I think very soon we'll probably realize that maybe N95 masks, for example, can be set aside, which will help a lot so that at a time when we really do need them, we'll have them available. The last F is story, only because I wanted to say communication and doesn't start from that. So the stories are really about worried well. Most of our emergency room patients are, about half of them have been worried well families. As you know, and many of you came to visit us at Children's yesterday, which we very much appreciate, most of all, those emergency room parents are, their children are on Medicaid. And 80% of the people we've been seeing are Spanish speaking only. So there's lots of stories to tell. There's a lot of learning that can come from this. How do we move back the message? And that's what we're partnering with the health department on, trying to have creative Spanish speaking community outreach so that if you don't come to the emergency room where really you don't want to come, if you're not ill, this is not the place you want to get your information. So moving that back upstream, internal and external communications, trying to keep our staff informed, and it's hard keeping ahead of CNN, but trying to get the best information we have available out to our staff in a timely manner. I'm a nurse, I come today, what do I do today? That's been one of our greatest challenges. And then last, I would just say, you know, we've heard some personality characteristics of this virus, and I would add wily and unpredictable, as most influenza viruses are. And while this may not be the top story for the coming days here, this will, for MDH and for Children's Infection Control and Infectious Disease, be the top story for the next year at least, because when this comes back, when flu season starts in the fall, we need to be prepared for any possibility of this wily organism. So I thank you very, very much for the invitation to come to me. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I think Representative Kalin had a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for convening the hearing and the update and inviting all of us. An observation and a question. I think Ms. Finchfield, hearing over and over and over, not just on the supplies but also on staff, this lesson is really we need to build depth. And that was a lesson from the 35W bridge class as well, that actually MnDOT was not prepared, and fortunately DPS had the trained personnel to step in and transfer over. And that worked extremely well, which goes to the question for Ms. How similar was this, was your response to a standard sort of trauma emergency like a bridge collapse or a structure collapse or other sort of single piece? You talked about using the EOC. Can you just describe, and hourly decisions, can you describe kind of who is incident command, who is in charge, who are the people in the room helping make those hourly decisions, and what lessons have you been able to share with county public health and emergency response folks around the state?
We responded initially, I think, the way you normally would in a tornado, in that the emergency manager, although there's a little bit of a twist here, the public health division director myself would then be joint command, which is how we had initially set it up. After less than 24 hours, it became clear, though, that because the issue is driving this response were really public health related, it became very clear that public health needed to be the incident commander, and in less than 24 hours, I became the incident commander, and our emergency manager became an EOC, or an Emergency Operations Center manager. So what he did is made sure I had what I needed in order for me to make my decisions, to communicate to individuals across the EOC and then outside to our own staff within the county or our resources in the community. And I would say that's one of the lessons that we learned, is that public health does need to be the incident commander here, but what we need is the skills and the resources that emergency management, who does this every day, brings to the table, and we need that as our support. And that works very, very well.
So a follow-up, Mr. Chair. If the strain was even more virulent than we're seeing, and you'd been the epicenter for, you know, 5, 10, 20 cases, and I'm sure you're prepared for, who relieves you? And I don't mean to be so detailed about this, but I think that, I mean, I've been in these responses, and it's pretty chilling to see how quickly, for instance, Rocco Forte had about 48 hours after which, if he didn't have his song number 2 and number 3, the whole response would have gone to hell in a handbasket. Mm-hmm. What was that situation like in Stearns County? And I assume you got the support from MDH, but who on the ground, would the emergency manager have enough knowledge of public health? Do you have a deputy, et cetera?
Right. Representative Kalen, Mr. Chair, how we have it set up in our county is that we have actually a variety of ways to go. We have an environmental services department that focuses on environmental health and other issues. That person has been designated as my backup, as well as we have another division director within our human services department that is also then designated as my backup. The human services division director, Janet Richardson, was my backup for this time period because it was a short time period, and we requested that the Environmental Services Department director move into the PIO and back that person up because there was such a health focus that we wanted that to be the backup for that. So we have a variety of different groups of individuals that we've tried to mentor through this process so that we have a little more flexibility in how we would respond based on what is the issue. So, however, I will tell you that it still is hard to find treatment just because we don't have a lot of staff at the level that we need them to be at. And particularly as we looked at, we also had operations going and logistics and planning, those positions open as well. Again, you have to have 2 to 3 weeks. I will tell you, though, that the City of St. Cloud has offered their assistance, and they did offer their assistance, and we used some of their staff as well from their environmental health department to help fill some of our gap as well. So it was very helpful for them to offer that assistance, and we willingly took that, and they did a great job.
Yeah. Senator Clark, and then
people often confuse us. Yeah, I'm always more than happy.
Well, it just surprised me that it's the same name.
We're working on a growing number of Clarks in the the Clark office. I think I doubled it. I think many people here know I live in St. Cloud, and along with Representative Hosh, the Recorded School District is part of my district. And I must say, while at first it was like, wow, you know, Cold Spring, that who would have expected Cold Spring? But I have to say, looking and thinking about what you were asking, Representative Kalen, we probably couldn't have picked, if we were going to have this happen, a better place for it to, because Cold Spring, the Recorded School District, for better or worse, has been at the forefront of figuring out how to deal with both emergency responsiveness and preparedness. And Stearns County has quite a tradition, both from how they utilize technology, but their community relationships. And frankly, we were expecting with the issues about potential people going after vaccines, the run on vaccines, that also our physician community has actually self-monitored pretty well in the past. And so, and the relationship with public health and the hospital, so a good place, especially because it's not a particularly urban place,
for this to happen. Now, it looks like perhaps we are not going to need to be doing what we did with the schools. But I got to say, our superintendent there, Scott Stasker, was up basically all night along with Renee. And it's pretty incredible watching just the things that we've done to prepare in the past, knowing that how long can you sustain this, that everything does work. It was like what happened when Boyfield Bridge collapsed. People came in, they knew exactly what to do. They put it into effect. And frankly, our community folks didn't panic because they actually knew these were the people to listen to. So it's a real testament, I think, to the systems that we have. We do need to make sure we've got the resources and the ability to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, one of the benefits of having you talk with us while we're in session is that if there are things that need to be done, this is a good time to be telling us. We can perhaps take some action. And I was listening to that today, and the only thing I really heard was that there are supplies in terms of masks that are insufficient. And so I would be interested if afterwards you could talk with us a little bit about, you know, whatever we might do with that. I heard you also say that you're switching from the kind of mask that was being recommended maybe to a different grade. Secondly, the interpreters. The availability of interpreters is a apparent need that we should maybe look at a little bit more. And then I think I heard overall that the public health infrastructure, we just need to make sure that it's deep enough, I think, as this is being talked about. And I know that we've had we've lost some of our depth. We don't have the degree of public health nurses that we used to have, for example, and so on. So I'm just inviting you, I guess, to give us some market orders in terms of what's ever left of, for these needs. I'm pleased that we have enough antivirals, and I'm actually a little concerned that they might be overused and maybe causing problems. But at any rate, I'm just interested in that, and I would invite you to talk with the three chairs here and others about what you might need us to think about if there is anything before the end of the session.
Mr. Chair, just one last shot. I know that we need to get to session and get rolling here, but I thought a great deal about this in some of the policy and legislation I carried after the 35W bridge to make sure that our state folks have the same level of professional certification as our local EM folks. But, looking at the legislators from St. Cloud who are in the room and knowing the expertise in health and sort of public management, Representative Hosh specifically is somebody who I think could have stepped in as needed to serve as a PIO. I'm actually 100% sincere on this, and I wonder if Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, if the Chair is here and others might want to work with me to talk. I thought about to Chris Ide, the State Homeland Security Emergency Management Director, about doing some briefings for legislators on how we can be helpful in these situations and not just sort of observing and even in the way, but actually step up as part of the depth if we can get the capacity building and the training. So just a thought down the road.
Well, thank you everybody for coming today and sharing this with us. And I hope we may follow up in a couple of months to see where things are and other lessons. Thank you. We're adjourned.